Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the program, a same-sex couple in Northwest Wyoming were recently told they are not welcome and need to leave.
You have a right to have your beliefs, but you can't infringe on other people's lives and their beliefs.
The 1988 fires that scorched Yellowstone National Park captivated the nation and marked a new chapter of massive wildfires in the West.
And I remember just being amazed that everywhere I looked for 360 degrees, I saw fire.
We start a new series focusing on water and fire in the West, including the point that all fires are not in forests.
On average, we actually see more acres of rangeland burning each year than we do of forest.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last weekend, a same-sex couple living about 20 miles west of Cody towards Yellowstone National Park were told by neighbors that they are not welcome in the community and should leave. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska takes a look to see if there's anything the couple can do about it.
On a crisp late fall afternoon, Colin Monahan and Shannon Listofsky Monahan were about to relax after a nice dinner with friends at their home in Wapiti.
There was a knock on the door, and Colin answered it. I heard some talking, but it was pleasant talking.
Shannon says she thought it was one of their guests who had forgotten something, so she went out the kitchen door to their small porch. Her wife, Colin, was surrounded by five neighbors who were allegedly there to talk about a covenant issue. One man was someone who had been harassing the couple online in the past. They asked him to leave, and he eventually did, but the rest of the group stayed.
They semicircled around the stairway, and a woman was next to me, and Colin asked, "Why are you harassing us?" The woman said, "It's because your kind is not welcome here. You pretend to be a man," pointing to Colin, "and try to fool people. You are not welcome here, and you need to leave."
At this point, the couple was scared. They asked everyone in the group to leave multiple times, but Shannon says they didn't move. So she went inside and called the sheriff.
The deputy picked up the line from 911, and Colin explained our situation and that these persons would not leave our property and were surrounding our entrance. She held the phone to them and said, "You're not leaving. Do you want to talk to the deputy?" And it was only then that they very slowly moved away from our property, went in their cars, and left.
The experience shook the Monahans. They moved to Wapiti 4 years ago from Chicago. Colin says they knew Wyoming is a conservative state and had a different culture.
But we moved out here because it's beautiful. We love the mountains. I love hunting, hiking, biking, all the things that people do out here, fishing. And so we've met other people who are also into those things, and we do those things together.
They say they didn't really experience any harassment in the beginning. But in the past couple of years, the climate, specifically on the internet, has changed.
You have a right to have your beliefs, but you can't infringe on other people's lives and their beliefs. So I think that hate crime legislation would certainly help to deter more of these kind of events from happening if people knew there were consequences.
Wyoming is one of the last states in the nation without a hate crime law. Laramie attorney Linda Devine says that means there's little people can do to defend themselves against such harassment.
Most of those are simple misdemeanors with a maximum 6 months jail and a fine. Judges aren't going to impose a sentence like that unless it's been repeated.
As the Monahan story spread throughout the Cody area, many people commented that Wyoming usually lets people live and let live.
Majority of people want to believe that, you know, it's just Wyoming, people let you do whatever you want to do, even if you don't agree with them. And I think increasingly we're seeing that that isn't the case.
Cheyenne State Representative Sarah Burlingame is co-sponsoring a hate crime legislation with Cody Representative Sandy Newsom in the upcoming general session in January. Some people say such legislation is not needed. Burlingame disagrees.
The law exists to draw distinctions between types of crime. Homicide is only different from manslaughter because of what someone's intention is. So hate crime just builds into that and says, hey, if you're targeting someone because of who they are, who they love, where they go to church, what country they were born in, that's a specific type of crime.
Meaning if her bill was current law, it could have applied to this incident. She says she believes this is how most people think.
We believe in small government. We believe that it is not our place to police your bedrooms or your lives, and that everybody should have the same access to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
There has been an outpour of support for the couple in the Cody area. People and businesses are hanging posters with phrases like, "Your hate is not welcome," and "Equality for all." And while they appreciate the support, the Monahans say it doesn't erase their fear.
Shannon can't even look out the window to see who's coming to our house anymore. I have to spend over $1,000 on a security system. I'll probably have to spend over $1,000 on lawyer fees. So we're the ones now that have to secure our place, look at all of our legal options, work on our mental health because of their incident of hatred. And yet they can get away with this. This really bothers me. It's not fair.
The Parr County Sheriff is not commenting as the incident is currently under investigation. So no information has been released. Members of the group accused of harassing the couple have not been publicly identified. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The city of Riverton is proud of its tradition of peacefully protesting against the acts of racism, but a new generation of activists is taking the lead, and they have a different idea of what those protests should look like. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
George Floyd's killing at the hands of Minneapolis police sparked a wave of protests across the country. And the first Wyoming town to join that national movement wasn't Laramie or Cheyenne or even Jackson. It was Riverton.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
Riverton is a conservative rural town of about 11,000 people. Not the kind of place where you'd expect to see a protest. But it's also surrounded by the Wind River Reservation. Leading this demonstration is a young Arapaho person named Micah Lott.
I write this for those who feel entitled to judge the outrage of anyone who have endured the infliction of pain, oppression, or injustice.
Hello, my name is Micah. My Arapaho name is Hisispeye, which means old man's son.
Lott is one of a handful of people in Fremont County who has experience organizing protests. They were a water protector at Standing Rock, probably the largest indigenous-led protest movement in history. But Lott traces their roots as an activist right back here to Riverton, Wyoming.
Yeah, I think it's kind of difficult to pinpoint when you come from a targeted community. I think that there's probably like a lot of pivotal points like in my life that pushed me to the forefront of organizing things.
One of those pivotal moments came in 2003, when Lott was only 9 years old. A white supremacist group with a history of violence announced that it would move its official headquarters to Riverton. People in Lott's circles were outraged and afraid.
The majority of the response had come from indigenous people, like the tribal leaders and people like that.
And from tribal youth.
I was shy, but I felt really deeply, and I still do today, that this is something I wanted to speak out against.
That's Stephanie Seahair. In 2003, she was a student at Wyoming Indian High School. She and some of her classmates wanted to plan a demonstration to show that Fremont County wouldn't tolerate white supremacy. But there was no roadmap for them to follow.
We didn't really see too many protests or peaceful marches or rallies before that.
And a lot of people in Fremont County wanted to keep it that way. The idea of a white supremacist group setting up shop in Riverton wasn't popular, but neither was the idea of a bunch of Native kids marching through town in protest.
Not everybody, including my principal, I don't think, was just all out thrilled.
Colleen Whalen was a teacher at Wyoming Indian at the time. She says there was a fear that things would get ugly.
There were families, and they came up to me and told me, the adults, that no, our family will not be coming. That walk is dangerous.
So there was a lot of pressure to keep this event not just peaceful, but positive. Stephanie Seahare says she and her classmates internalized that.
We didn't want to divide people. We want everybody to come together. So we came together and did the whole peaceful protests. You know, we did the walk from Walmart to the city park.
And it was a success. Hundreds of people came out to support them. There was no violence and no counter-protesters. Every year since 2003, Wyoming Indian High School has organized a Martin Luther King Day walk in Riverton. The event has become something of a blueprint for activism in Fremont County. Ron Howard leaned on that blueprint in the summer of 2015 when Riverton was grappling with another act of hate. A white City Parks employee had shot two Northern Arapaho men in the head while they were asleep at a detox facility. Sonny Goggles survived the shooting but was severely injured. Stallone Trosper died that day. Howard says it felt like a punch in the gut.
That something so brazen and so bold could have happened. I was angry and I was confused and I didn't know what to do, but I knew somebody had to do something.
Howard wanted to make sure that what happened wasn't swept under the rug. So every July, he organizes a peace march through downtown Riverton. Howard strives to keep the tone of the event positive, despite the violence that prompted it. From the beginning, he says some people haven't been on board with that.
A lot of people were so angry that they said, no, we don't want to do that. We need to do something more. But in the name of peace and tolerance, that was about the only thing I could think of.
One of those people is Micah Lott. They say all this focus on peace and unity lets racist people and systems off the hook.
It seems as if it's like Band-Aids to like the much larger issue, because it's like we want results. We don't want this to keep happening.
So the protests Lott organizes look a lot different.
No justice, no peace. No racist police. No justice, no peace. No racist police.
Since 2003, Lott has watched Riverton's protest tradition take shape. The Martin Luther King Day walk and the annual peace marches have helped shape their identity as an activist. But Lott is tired of being polite.
Why do we have to be put in that position where there's this continuance violence put against us, and then we have to be the peaceful ones, and we have to be the polite ones, and we have to be the ones that have nonviolent communication to be able to have these dialogues, and yet still nothing changes?
Lott says Native people in Riverton are only listened to when they're calm and cooperative. And as long as that's the case, they say nothing is going to change. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
Please support Open Spaces with your pledge of support at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We honestly cannot bring you the high-quality news you hear every week without it. We have reporters stationed all across the state, and as you hear, we partner with other organizations in the region to bring important stories on this show and during our daily news offerings. Once again, please support us at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And when we come back, we will explore the issue of the lack of women in the legislature and the problem of underfunded rangers. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, the super wealthy are moving into rural America with grand plans to help small towns. But it doesn't always pan out.
He bought up all those buildings on Main Street and boarded them up. And he's killing the town.
A Stranger Comes to Town, part 3 of the Ghost Towning series. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In Wyoming history, women have won only 133 legislative races. Since about half the state is made up of women, it means they seriously lack representation. The problem has been talked about for years. Freshman State Representative Shelley Duncan of Lengel noticed it in the few times she came to Cheyenne to lobby on some issues.
My interaction, limited as it was that the legislature was filled with old men, older men, and the demographics as well being those of ranchers and attorneys.
Duncan is a realtor, and she thought it was critical to get a professional woman's voice into the debate. She's a Republican who thought about running for many years but couldn't afford it when her children were younger, and then being away from work would have been an additional challenge. Then there's other considerations.
Can your personality fit in and the dynamics deal with a heavily male-dominated, patriarchal, traditional scenario in the legislature? It's a good old boy situation. Can you deal with that?
Duncan can and has added a voice on business and women's issues. She can remember several debates over the past couple of years where it became obvious that men knew little about some critical issues facing families, like problems paying for child care. Chris Merrill is the director of the Equality State Policy Center. He says the need for women to give their perspective is critical.
You just need those voices in the room as part of the conversation, or else, you know, so many things just are never said, they're never thought of, and the debates are less robust. The policy is less informed, and so you want as much as possible to have the legislature represent the population.
House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly agrees. Connolly has lacked friends in the room when she's tried to tackle issues like child care and wage disparities. While there is a need to get more women elected, Connolly says the women who are there need to be chosen to play more significant roles, especially in the Republican Party.
I am the minority leader of the House Democrats, but there are no women in top leadership and only 2 out of 20 who are chairs of committees. In the last legislative session, there were no women who were chair of legislative committees.
Just to show you how big a deal having a woman in leadership is, 3 have either served as speakers of the House or Senate president, and 2 have schools named after them. Connolly says if more women get into the legislature, it stands to reason that more women will play a more significant role. But getting them there is difficult. Marguerite Herman of the League of Women Voters says part of the problem is the increased workload.
It used to be just the sessions, right? And now it's all this interim work and then preparing for the interim work and then following up on it. Once again, it makes it extremely hard for younger people and women.
That's because many don't have the kinds of jobs that will let them take on a task like the legislature. Representative Duncan says it's certainly a problem.
Biggest thing I think that's more difficult for a woman than it is for a man is proximity. You're going to find a lot more women being able to leave for 2 months if they're closer to the Capitol than if they're from across the state.
That theory tends to play out. In the last election, 5 Republican women were elected to the Senate, and 3 were from Cheyenne. Another was from Torrington. Connolly thinks one reform will help that.
I think we need to make the legislature more of an institution that acknowledges, accepts, and recruits parents. Now, that includes men as well, but we need to consider things such as child care and the importance of being able to care for your children while serving in the legislature as well.
Connolly tried a child care-friendly proposal this year that failed on the floor when some male legislators suggested they needed help taking care of livestock. Despite that unfortunate discussion, she's optimistic that the proposal will eventually pass. And then there's another idea.
I think that having health care would make all the difference.
She proposes allowing legislators to get into the state health care system. Duncan and Connolly note that there does seem to be a number of women trying for legislative seats this year, and they are hopeful that the numbers will finally improve. The U.S. Forest Service has faced budget cuts and underfunding for years. So with the agency's blessing, around 200 conservation groups across the country have created volunteer wilderness ranger programs to help patrol the backcountry. But are volunteers a good substitute for funding full-time staff? The Mountain West News Bureau's Amanda Peacher reports.
I'm starting out on a 10-mile hike in central Idaho. The sun is beating down and it's about 80 degrees. Joining me on this trek,
I'm Joyce Fauber. I'm a volunteer wilderness steward, and we're at the Iron Creek Trailhead getting ready to hike to Sawtooth Lake.
This is an area that some describe as loved to death. Visitors are drawn to an unusually large, deep blue alpine lake set against a backdrop of granite peaks. Every year, tens of thousands come to see it, and that's why Joyce Fauber is here.
So we picked this one today so that we could kind of do the job and help educate people, greet people.
Fauber is a retired chemical engineer, but now she's one of about 40 volunteers with the Idaho Conservation League. The nonprofit started this program because the Forest Service doesn't have enough money to fully staff the backcountry with rangers. So volunteers like Fauber are trying to fill the gap.
Yeah. Okay. So shall we get started?
Yeah, let's go. About a quarter mile in, Fauber is already meeting hikers on the trail. That means being friendly.
Hi, how are you? Did you have a good hike?
Checking conditions.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully nobody's leaving behind trash or campfires or anything like
nope,
that.
Didn't see any of that funny
beautiful.
Business.
Yeah.
And later when she sees hikers breaking the rules, Fauber gently lets them know that's not okay.
And you do know your dog has to be on a leash.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Much of what Fauber does as a volunteer is also the role of a wilderness ranger, to educate, communicate, and monitor. And I know this well because in college, I was a ranger here in the Sawtooths. I spent summers up here. But there's one big difference between what I used to do and what Fauber does. She can't enforce rules. If someone has an illegal campfire or rides their bike in the wilderness or they run amok cutting down live trees, Fauber can't give them a ticket.
Volunteers cannot do everything that needs to be done.
That's Randy Welsh, and he heads up the nonprofit Wilderness Stewardship Alliance.
They can fill in, but they're not a long-term solution.
Over roughly the past decade, Welsh says he's seen volunteers essentially take the place of paid Forest Service workers.
Volunteers are the de facto workforce for many Forest Service districts that have a wilderness program because they do not have the funding, the capability to hire wilderness seasonals.
And agency records show that wilderness and wild and scenic river volunteer hours have increased about 36% since 2013. Bottom line, overall, the funding for wilderness programs and its staff is going down, and that means volunteers are becoming an essential part of forest stewardship. Ken Gebhardt is a district ranger in the Salmon Chalice National Forest in central Idaho.
I think we all recognize we can't do it alone.
But Gebhardt says it's a good thing that the volunteer force is growing.
The volunteer program and all the partners we work with are all part of the big picture of our success of managing national forests.
He sees it as a win-win. Back on the trail to Sawtooth Lake, Joyce Fauber probably agrees.
86.
She's finishing up for the day with one of her many duties, counting the number of hikers she ran into.
100, so 128.
That's 128 people Fauber checked for permits, chatted with about wilderness, or asked to put their dogs on leash. There was no actual wilderness ranger on this trail today, so without Fauber, those 128 people wouldn't have had that kind of interaction.
I had a fun day.
And she doesn't plan to give this up anytime soon.
By acting as a wilderness steward, I get to slow down and really appreciate the experience more than if I were just hiking as fast as I could. And interacting with all these friendly people was fun.
She says she hopes the Forest Service can fully staff trails and ranger programs in the future. But in the meantime, she'll be out on the trail every week. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher in the Sawtooth Mountains.
Coming up, we will bring you a series of stories on water and fires in the West from throughout the region. And during this break, think about making a pledge to Wyoming Public Radio. This program, Open Spaces, has won 9 national awards for Best News and Public Affairs Program. But we can't do it without you. Please support the program at wyomingpublicmedia.org, and thank you. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Sharon Ross wanted to be prepared for anything, but she found herself the odd one out.
If I sit in an open chair next to somebody, that person would get up and move. Or act like they have to go to the bathroom or go get some water or something and then end up sitting somewhere else.
The Afrovivalist. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. In the summer of 1988, Yellowstone National Park was engulfed in flames. TV coverage of the fires captivated the nation for months. After the fire was extinguished, plenty of thorny questions remained. What did those fires mean for the park's near pristine rivers and lakes? And what is their legacy? Today we start a series taking a closer look at where water and fire intersect across the West. From KHOL, Robin Vincent reports from Jackson.
A better way to wake up in the morning. Oh my God. The sound.
National Park Service hydrologist Aaron White is at Kepler Cascades, where white water plunges 150 feet into the Firehole River. The multi-tiered waterfall is flanked by a sea of mature lodgepole pine trees. Dotted in between are young trees that sprouted after the 1988 fires.
You can see some of the variation in the landscape and the types of environments that were affected.
The 1988 Yellowstone fires torched more than a third of the park and touched nearly all of its landscapes in some way. That meant
very few watersheds in Yellowstone were not impacted.
White likes to call Yellowstone America's first water park. It's home to the headwaters of multiple major rivers and hundreds of waterfalls. Thousands of geysers, mud pots, and hot springs gush, bubble, and boil here too. Because the 1988 fires focused the nation's attention on wildfire for months, soon after, scientists descended on the park to study the impacts. What they found reflects the fire's legacy of renewal. Small streams were affected in the short term with ashy runoff, but big bodies of water showed little change in water quality. That resilience proved important. Back then, saving and then recovering watersheds wasn't top of mind for overwhelmed fire managers. Human-built infrastructure was the priority.
Good morning. Those wildfires raging in the area of Yellowstone National Park show no signs of...
Very quickly, it became apparent that we did not have and could not have the resources to contain the fires, despite the best effort of thousands of firefighters.
That's Steve Fry, a former incident commander. He and his team were laser focused on protecting three things:
firefighters, the public, and those iconic developments within the park.
Icons like the historic Old Faithful Inn, built in 1903. Former Yellowstone historian Lee Whittlesey was a law enforcement ranger at the time.
Old Faithful was surrounded by fires on all sides, and I remember just being amazed that everywhere I looked for 360 degrees, I saw fire.
For Incident Commander Fry, the fires signaled a paradigm shift. They ushered in a new chapter of massive, frequent fires that communities across the West face today. And they expanded our understanding of wildfires' vital ecological process.
It was, for many of us in wildland fire management, something that we had never experienced before. But the magnitude and the fire behavior we have experienced a number of times since.
The subtext here is climate change. It's fueling longer, more intense fire seasons. Montana State University paleoecologist Kathy Whitlock studies how climate influences fire. She was in Yellowstone in the summer of 88, but she wasn't there for the fires. Whitlock was examining the history of the park's plants, and the fires were simply a nuisance.
I hadn't really even thought about fire as being something worthy of attention because there hadn't been fires in Yellowstone for a long time.
In the end, The fires refocused her career. She pioneered a way to trace back fire history thousands of years using charcoal from the park's lakes and streams. And she found that in many western forests, wildfires have long played a key ecological role. But today, with a smaller window between fires, the concern is
there won't be enough time for trees to establish, for seeds to disperse.
In turn, forests could transform into grasslands. This all dials back to water. In 1988, Yellowstone saw a profoundly dry summer, priming it for megafires. It was the kind of hot, dry summer that will likely become more frequent in the years ahead, putting Yellowstone's wildfire resilience to the test. I'm Robin Vincent in Jackson, Wyoming.
Major wildfires have burned through the western U.S. this year. Fires can have immediate effects on air quality in nearby homes, but now people are coming to grips with the lingering danger of wildfires long after the flames are gone. Today, we continue our in-depth look at where water and fire intersect in the West. As Aspen Public Radio's Alex Hager reports, people who live near burn scars can find themselves in a brand new flood zone.
There's a creek running through Sue Lavin's backyard, about 20 feet away from the house. She lives alone and says the running water makes for good company.
Corny as it sounds, I consider the creek my friend and live with it in a really lovely way every day, and it's very relaxing.
In the waning days of summer, that creek is just a low, gentle babble, slowly making its way into the nearby Colorado River. But Lavin has seen it get much higher and much louder during peak runoff.
You can't have a conversation anywhere near the creek. You really have to be. I belong to two book clubs, and I could never have the meetings at my house because nobody would understand each other.
Now, there's a serious threat that the creek could swell with water and debris at levels she's never seen before, levels that could seriously damage her property. Lavin's house is in No Name, Colorado, just a stone's throw away from the furthest reaches of the Grizzly Creek fire, which burned more than 30,000 acres. And although the fire is almost entirely contained now, it'll have lingering effects for years to come. And one of those is the serious threat of flooding.
It's not a maybe. It is an absolute gonna happen.
That is Carol Acarius, who heads up a Colorado-based nonprofit that helps communities respond to big fires. She says severity of flooding in No Name is hard to predict without a crystal ball, but she does know there will be flooding, here and near burned areas across the West. The reason for that? Fire burns up vegetation and soil that usually hold water.
Basically, soil and rocks will age in a high-intensity fire, like the equivalent of 1,000 years worth of aging from just sun, wind, rain, and ice.
Then when it does rain, even just a little bit, that soil is charred and the water can't sink in. Instead, it just flows straight downhill. And because of the damage to the soil, it doesn't take that much rain to cause a big flood.
The 1-year storm does behave like a 10-year or greater event. And the 10-year storm behaves like a 100 to maybe 500-year event.
And this isn't just clear rainwater that rushes downhill. Acarius says it'll pick up all kinds of dirt and brush and rocks along the way. So a bad rainstorm could send a slurry of muddy debris speeding down a creek bed that just can't handle it.
Sometimes it's moving rocks that are the size of a Volkswagen. So these are boulders, not rocks. And when something the size of a Volkswagen hits the side of your house, it is significantly damaging.
That debris can also plug up culverts or narrow, windy parts of the creek and lead to pooling and flooding near homes. So in No Name, there's a team from the Natural Resources Conservation Service picking out spots to put sandbags and rock walls to help it handle increased flow. One summer afternoon, Stephen Jowen was leading one of those teams and surveying the creek right behind people's houses and backyards.
As we move up and down this creek, we're looking at where the bends are, where the deposition is, where river water is moving efficiently, where it might be pooling, because that might be a place where things could gather.
Jowen says the No Name creek bed is actually pretty deep and could handle more water, but they're still preparing for that worst-case scenario.
We'll do some changes of the infrastructure a little bit just to make sure that if something does get clogged, that it has a path of least resistance to go that doesn't go into somebody's house.
One of the houses that'll likely need some protection is Sue Lavin's. She's heard all the recommendations and is preparing for the worst, whether that be a one-time evacuation or floods that get so dangerous they mean leaving no name for good.
If things get bad enough, I will have to adjust my life. I will find that heartbreaking, and even thinking about it is heartbreaking. But I'm not a fool. I will prepare for such an instance, and if I have to take it, I will take it.
No Name hasn't seen a heavy rain or snow since the fire, but Lavin has already started cutting back the brush around her property for the day it does come. I'm Alex Hager in No Name, Colorado.
For many Western communities, their water supplies originate from melting snow high up in the mountains. But this summer's record-breaking wildfires have reduced some headwater forests to burnt trees and heaps of ash. As Luke Runyon from KUNC reports, wildfires can cause problems for municipal drinking water systems for years to come.
Until 8 years ago, the city of Fort Collins, Colorado's main water source, the Poudre River, was nearly pristine. It tumbled out of the Rocky Mountains into the city's treatment plant, no problem.
We had been privileged and in some ways probably took for granted that these watersheds were providing us consistently clean, clear water all the time.
That's the city's water quality manager, Jill Oropeza. We're along the river just outside of town, downstream of where the High Park Fire burned more than 87,000 acres in 2012.
And that was the first time for many of us working there that we had to kind of grapple with the fact that our watersheds are under pressure.
For the first year after the fire, every time it rained, the river turned black. Mudslides of ash and scorched soil spilled into it. And before workers could turn off the river's intake, that muddy water clogged pipes leading to the treatment plant.
We ended up with a lot of sediment in our pipelines that was difficult to remove.
And even if they got the water through the full treatment process, it still tasted and smelled smoky. That led the city to install an early warning system. From where we're standing, you can see a long metal pipe stuck in the middle of the river. It's measuring how turbid or cloudy the water is. If the sensor detects too much sediment, utility workers can turn off the plant's intake and switch to water from a large reservoir to avoid clogged pipes.
It became really important for us to have a heads up for when those changes in water quality were occurring.
The effects of the High Park's burn scar on water quality only lasted a few years, but this early warning system is about to get a lot more use because this summer's Cameron Peak Fire has burned another broad sweep of the river's watershed.
I think that's one of the most important points about this whole fire is that it's in a sort of high value location for water supply in the Front Range.
Chuck Rhodes is with the Forest Service's Rocky Mountain Research Station and studies how big disturbances in forests can affect water quality. Between the High Park and Cameron Peak fires, nearly the entire southern half of the Poudre River watershed has burned in the last decade. And Rhodes says that will have big impacts on people downstream.
Whether they're agriculturalists, whether they're residential folks, whether they're people that are floating the river or the aquatic, you know, the aquatic organisms that are using the river, they're all really linked to what's happening in those headwater forests.
But because the High Park fire happened so recently, Fort Collins might be more prepared than other places in the West to deal with this new fire. Jen Kovexis runs the nonprofit Coalition for the Poudre River Watershed. She says the people who formed her group after High Park are already talking about recovery from the current one while it's still burning.
It doesn't make the situation less stressful, or maybe it makes it moderately less stressful, but the reality, I think, a fire footprint this big is just, it's a lot to take in.
Kovexis says the 2020 fire season has renewed a region-wide discussion about forest health. And if cities want to avoid long-term water quality problems, she says they need to be thinking about how to first reduce the risk of megafires.
In the West, it's not a question of if it will happen to your community. It's a question of when one of these large events will happen to your communities.
Back on the banks of the Poudre River, the city of Fort Collins' Jill Oropeza says decisions made after the last big fire, like building new infrastructure to remove sediment, will help them respond this time around. And they already have relationships with researchers, federal agencies, and others to ease the burden.
We live in fire-prone watersheds, and that it's our part of our responsibility to adapt to those, that reality.
A reality that includes drier forests, hotter summers, and extended fire seasons across the West. I'm Luke Runyon in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Coming up, a story from Sheridan that explains that wildfires don't just happen in forests. Our Wyoming Public Radio newsroom has won 11 national and regional awards this year alone, including 6 regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. And you know, we can't do any of this without your financial support. So please take a moment and help keep this coverage strong with your pledge today. You can make it at wyomingpublicmedia.org. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Kids Ask Why, we take a look at a geological formation known as hoodoos.
Enjoy them now because a lot of them are so fragile they won't be around for a whole lot longer.
And learn why public lands are important in the state.
Public lands really embodies the very word of freedom.
Hannah, Molly, and Sunday ask adults the hard questions.
Thanks for talking to me today.
That's it. You're easy.
Find Kids Ask Why under podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wildfires and drought are hitting the Mountain West especially hard this year, and fires don't just burn in forests. Grasslands, starved of moisture and chock full of invasive plants, can burn just as big. Catherine Wheeler of Wyoming Public Radio reports on how researchers are looking at solutions to keep grassland fires in check.
I'm standing on the side of a rocky hill in Sheridan County in northern Wyoming, and Brian Mueller is showing me all of his weeds.
Here, let me grab a cheatgrass so you can see it too. They all kind of look the same this time of year.
Yeah, this is a mix. Mueller is the director of the University of Wyoming's Research and Extension Center in Sheridan, and he's performing experiments on how to manage and kill invasive annual grasses like cheatgrass, ventonata, and medusa head with herbicides. His goal is to restore rangeland to its more natural state, and as a result, hopefully make events like wildfires less devastating. But first, it's helpful to understand what these uninvited guests are and why they are harmful to this environment. Dan Tekela is an invasive plant extension specialist at the University of Wyoming. He says there are 3 things that make plants invasive. Starting with the easiest, they aren't from here.
Generally, what we think is something coming from another country, so crossing over something like an ocean or a large boundary to get here.
And that allows them to spread easily, overwhelming native plants. In Wyoming and much of the West, impacts come to ranchers on rangeland, where these invaders can take over areas meant for grazing. That means less vegetation for animals and wildlife to eat, making the land harder to use. And like all strong enemies, invasive plants are formidable. Tekela says invasive plants quickly take over what's supposed to be a patchy landscape and die, creating a lot of wildfire fuel.
They create these really, really thick patches and cause more problems by creating these large fires that wouldn't happen because typically we have plenty of what's called interspace in those plants so that the fires don't really spread all that well.
Most of the attention around wildfires tends to surround forests, and while losing trees and concerns about public safety are really important, Tekela says there are equal concerns about rangeland too.
We have the exact same issues in rangeland. They just aren't as flashy in that they don't create as much smoke. There's not as much biomass to burn. However, in terms of acreage, on average, we actually see more acres of rangeland burning each year than we do of forest.
And Takela says the increased drought across the West isn't helping. These invasive plants can grow back much quicker than native species after a fire, and they can grow with very little water, and that just creates a cycle of problems. So how are Mueller and other researchers trying to fix all this? Back on the hillside, he's showing me about 18 different plots. They were sprayed with an herbicide in different amounts at different times of year.
I mean, you can see exactly where I sprayed and where I didn't, right? It's not like there's this sort of vague line. I mean, it is, it's like you just came up here and erased it. See the, like the upper plots right here above us?
Some plots, everything is dead. Some plots still have plenty of brown and green villains, but in others, bright green western wheatgrass is springing up from the ground. Mueller says that's the goal with these spraying experiments.
So we've got a bunch of annual grasses, but there's still a bunch of good guys that are in there as well. And so if we can just reduce the pressure from the annual grasses, then we see a really good recovery from those perennial plants.
Mueller says these experiments and results aren't limited to Wyoming. There are other scientists working on the same issues across the West. In fact, the Western Governors Association has an invasive species working group where agencies can discuss how these experiments are working in states with different conditions.
As we cooperate with one another and with industry and with landowners and agencies, and we see a pattern like that that is very consistent across Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, Utah, Idaho, wherever else, then it really increases our confidence.
Mueller says as they start to see consistent results, they can start making recommendations to landowners and managers, and it means researchers are steps closer to understanding how to take the bad guys out for good. I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan, Wyoming.
After decades of trying to get ahead of the problem of the West's big fires, it seems we're still behind. The massive fires that have burned this year don't just alter forests, they impact water supplies for people and the environment. But a record-breaking wildfire season could also refocus efforts to better manage forests. In the final story of our series looking at where water and fire meet in the West, Ron Duggan from KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
In June of 2002, nearly 500,000 acres burned in the Arizona High Country. The Rodeo Chedisky Fire was the largest fire in Arizona history at the time, and it got everyone's attention. There was too much fuel in the forest, and something needed to be done.
So I think the first thing to recognize is that the Southwest and California are built to burn.
That's Arizona State University Professor Stephen Pine.
We get lots of dry lightning. We're the epicenter for lightning-caused fires in the United States.
Ponderosa forests evolved with fire. Modest-sized fires would burn grasses, small trees, and brush, but leave the big trees standing. Then overgrazing and fire suppression removed grasses and allowed small trees to grow unchecked. By the time foresters figured out the problem, megafires were on the way. Ethan Amick is with the Grand Canyon Trust. He remembers 10,000-acre thinning projects in the 90s, which felt like significant progress.
We realized that we were not working at the scale at which wildfire was working.
And so Arizona ranchers, conservationists, politicians, foresters, and local communities put aside their differences and came up with a plan, the Four Forest Restoration Initiative, FORFRI for short. Amick says the goal was to thin more than 2 million acres across the state, from the Grand Canyon to New Mexico.
The problem is not getting smaller. The problem is only getting larger in Arizona. The same can be said across the West.
There are two ways to thin the forest, cutting and burning. FORFRI did both. The target for cutting is small diameter trees. That's different from traditional logging, which takes the big, fire-resistant ones. Elvie Barton is with Salt River Project, which provides power and water for the Phoenix metro area through a series of dams. She says forests aren't just for wildlife and hiking. They're often headwaters for crucial rivers and streams the region's biggest cities rely on.
We all have overgrown forests. We have endangered species. We have large catastrophic wildfires that are, you know, coming through and just devastating these landscapes and having these horrible impacts on communities and the water supplies.
Although FORFRI seemed to address the problem on paper, companies hired to thin the forest failed to deliver. The forest kept growing, and in 2011, the Wallow Fire took out another 500,000 acres in eastern Arizona, climate change, drought, and growing housing development have made the problem more complex. Different ecosystems have different fire regimes, and today's fires can jump from one to the next. Fire historian Pines says that firefighters are allowing some fires to burn within certain parameters.
I'm seeing a lot of from fire officers on the ground that we're not going to get ahead of this in that way. We're riding the tiger. There are too many things coming at us too fast, changing things too rapidly. We're having to work with what we're given.
Using prescribed burns to thin the forest is complicated, but Four Fry is beginning to meet its targets. The project has also done work in springs and watershed restoration. And not all wildfires are catastrophic. Some places that burn recover, like Canyon Creek, which burned in Rodeo Chedisky. The Forest Service hopes to ramp up thinning in the near future, but Grand Canyon Trust's Ethan Amick wonders if we can correct past mistakes.
On the other hand, I actually feel very optimistic and sometimes foolishly so that we can solve this problem, and I really think the question is, can we do it in time?
Charlie Esters with Salt River Project. He says he thinks that Four Fry can work if it moves forward one step at a time.
We're not giving up. We're going to continue. The Forest Service is not giving up. They're going to continue. The Collaborative is not giving up. We all have to work together. We all have this common goal, and I'm very positive about the future of our forest ecosystem.
18 years later, you can still see the scars from Rodeo Chedisky at Canyon Creek. But there are trees standing, and clear water is flowing. You'll find trout in the stream, elk in the hills, coyotes. More fires are coming. The only question is how hot they will burn and how much ground they will consume. I'm Ron Dungan in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces, that last series looking at where water and wildfire intersect in the West. It was produced by KUNC, KJZZ, KHOL, Aspen Public Radio, and Wyoming Public Radio. Support comes from the Walton Family Foundation. Now, speaking of support, you can provide support to Wyoming Public Radio with your pledge today at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You know, we can't bring you this high-quality program and local news without your pledge. And while you're on the website, you can also listen to individual segments or sign up for our podcast. Thanks to Anna Rader for taking care of our web needs. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.